This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. A really interesting show today. This week, a historic summit between U.S. President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. We'll talk about its implications according to Bible prophecy. When did everything become so political? After the Parkland shooting, a social media campaign pressured businesses to cut ties with the National Rifle Association, and businesses started to take sides. More and more companies are taking political positions on issues totally unrelated to their business regarding gun rights, social issues like race, gender, homosexuality. What effect is this having on America economically and socially? We'll hear a report about this from Trumpet writer Andrew Miller. We also have a report on a stunning example of moral relativism, where you had people on the left actually defending the practice of killing sick children because the practice was taking place in a remote indigenous tribe in the Amazon. Richard Palmer is going to show the kind of moral knots you get into when everything is relative. At the end of the show, I want to give you some thoughts about gardening, not physical gardening, but spiritual gardening, bearing fruit in your life, how you can do that and for what purpose. But first, the North Korea summit.
It's my honor today to address the people of the world following this very historic summit with Chairman Kim Jong-un of North Korea. Spent very intensive hours together. And I think most of you have gotten the signed document, or you will very shortly. It's very comprehensive. It's going to happen. I stand before you as an emissary of the American people to deliver a message of hope and vision and a message of peace.
That was U.S. President Donald Trump after the meeting. He and Kim Jong-un signed a joint statement after their historic meeting on Tuesday, which read in part, Kim Jong-un reaffirmed his firm and unwavering commitment to complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. So we've come a long way since the nuclear brinkmanship and the bellicose rhetoric coming from these two leaders just months ago when North Korea was testing missiles capable of reaching the whole continental United States. And President Trump was calling Chairman Kim Little Rocket Man and threatening to use nuclear weapons. Is the Korean Peninsula about to achieve peace? Now, this is a really difficult situation to read accurately. There are many unknowns, and there are several different ways of looking at what's happened here. But when you view these events through the lens of Bible prophecy, it seems clear that this summit will, in fact, move events in the direction of peace in the short term. Last summer, when tensions between North Korea and the U.S. were hottest, and many commentators were saying that these tensions would start a nuclear World War III, the Trumpet looked at the Bible's prophecies, and we took a very different view. Trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques wrote an article titled, Does Bible Prophecy Say North Korea Could Trigger World War III? And he showed how prophecy reveals that there is a nuclear war coming, but it's clear that it will not be North Korea that sparks that war. And to have seen these nations step away from that nuclear brink vindicates that analysis. You can read that article on thetrumpet.com to see the scenario that's specifically explained in the Bible's prophecies. But looking at these events through that lens does give a perspective that you can't gain from just listening to the speeches, reading the agreement, listening to the reporting on this recent summit. And it does suggest that this move in a peaceful direction is not just an illusion. First of all, it is important to recognize just how terrible life for the people of North Korea really is. Life for most of the country's 25 million citizens is a nightmare. One out of every 100 is imprisoned, mostly on trumped-up charges of treason. Prisoners regularly suffer abuse and torture. Even free citizens live in grim squalor. The average North Korean lives on $25 to $30 per month. More than three-quarters of North Koreans are starving. One out of every three children is severely malnourished to the point of stunted growth. And the people aren't allowed to leave. There are fences and walls all around the nation. Soldiers open fire on people who try to escape. Anyone who's caught is killed or tortured. And if one individual attempts to escape, whether he's successful or not, authorities often brutally punish everyone in his family, even small children. This regime, the Kim Jong-un regime, controls information. Every word printed in any book or newspaper has to be approved by the government. Practicing religion is a criminal offense, punishable by imprisonment or death. And every word spoken on radio or TV is censored by or written by the regime. The government uses its grip on information to lie and to brainwash the people. They say this country is paradise. It's the best nation on earth. People in other countries are racially inferior savages who are far poorer than you. Your leader is a god. He's the only god, in fact. You should worship and bow to him. You are infantile, and you need his benevolent guidance. This is the kind of life that the people of North Korea lead. And there is some cause for hope and optimism that these recent developments may actually cause North Korea's economy to be opened up and that this country may actually be able to become more normal and gain a certain amount of prosperity. And that would be genuine celebration. That would be cause for real hope and celebration for the sake of those 25 million people. It is possible that Kim Jong-un, who was educated in Switzerland, that he may be more open to westernization and freedom than his father and his grandfather were, who ruled before him. And if you think about those 25 million North Koreans, you have to agree with this statement from President Trump in his press conference after the summit.
Their eyes are wide open, but peace is always worth the effort, especially in this case.
Now, the agreement that Trump and Kim signed was very light on specifics regarding denuclearization. It doesn't say verifiable. It doesn't say irreversible. There's no timetable given. So it does, in some ways, this deal looks similar to what other agreements that North Korea has signed over the years, promising to denuclearize. These are promises that North Korea has broken before. However, if peace is possible, you have to start somewhere. And President Trump is talking like this process is just getting started. And there are definitely factors suggesting this time is different. Kim Jong-un has been making some unprecedented moves lately. Just weeks ago, he crossed into South Korea, the first time any North Korean leader did that for as long as the two nations have existed as separate countries. And he agreed to formally end the Korean War by the end of the year. He committed to complete denuclearization of his nation with no strings attached. This is extraordinary. These things have never happened before. But to understand this situation, it is important for us to keep our eyes on China. As the Trumpet's editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, has brought out, China is far more powerful than North Korea, and China has been propping up the North Korean regime for decades. There is evidence that China is encouraging these overtures of peace, and that the way things are unfolding is actually working in China's favor. You remember that back on March 25th, this was before Kim's outreach to South Korea and the United States, that Kim made a surprise visit to China, his first foreign trip since he assumed power back in 2011. And it was only after that historic meeting with Chinese President Xi Jinping that Kim began reaching out to America and South Korea with these offers of peace. And then on May 8th, Kim made a second visit to China for a second meeting with President Xi. And right after that, he began retracting all of those olive branches that he had offered. That was when President Trump canceled the June 12th summit. And this is what we wrote on our website at the time. We said that China may have been deliberately creating ambiguity and confusion and using this wavering by North Korea, this wavering between charm and threats, quote, to distract the Trump administration for as long as possible. Such diversions could allow Xi to cement his hold on the South China Sea and to delay America's imposition of trade tariffs on China for several months. Now, if you think about China being behind this, and I think it's probably quite safe to assume that China is certainly allowing this, if not orchestrating it, look at what happened at this summit through China's eyes. What tangible thing did President Trump agree to at this summit? Well, he agreed to stop war games and military exercises with South Korea. And he mentioned the possibility of pulling American troops out of South Korea. Now, this is interesting because in 2017, China and Russia proposed what was called a freeze-for-freeze deal. North Korea would suspend its nuclear and missile programs if the U.S. would end its military exercises with South Korea. Now, at that time, both North Korea and the U.S. rejected that plan. Well, now, both nations agreed to it, and they did that on their own. That was the substance of the agreement between Trump and Kim. So essentially, out of this summit, Russia and China got what they were asking for a year ago. Now, this is what Quartz, the website Quartz, wrote about this. After the historic summit today between U.S. President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, there's one clear winner, China. The plan outlined in the two leaders' joint statement turns out to be exactly what Beijing wants. And, you know, after the summit, China came out and said that it was pleased with what resulted from the summit. China's foreign minister, Wang Yi, said this: "The United States and North Korea have been in a state of antagonism for more than half a century. Today, that the two countries' highest leaders can sit together and have equal talks has important and positive meaning and is creating a new history. China, of course, supports it." China would love to see America remove its presence in South Korea. It would love to see America's influence in Asia diminish. And it could be that it sees peace with North Korea as the best way of achieving that. If you look at what's happening here through China's eyes, you see a lot is working in China's favor. The United States and its allies have seen their influence decreasing in the Western Pacific. Over the last year, with all the back and forth drama between the United States and North Korea, China has continued to increase its military activities in the South China Sea. Some would argue this is the most strategically valuable large body of water in the world. It's a transit for millions of barrels of oil. It has trillions of cubic feet of natural gas under it. And the U.S. has done nothing to stop China from claiming this sea almost entirely as its own territorial waters. China keeps building islands. It's disregarding the findings of the International Tribunal for the Law of the Sea. The relationship between the United States and the Philippines has taken a big hit. The U.S. Navy presence on Okinawa has been reduced at the same time that the People's Liberation Army, China's presence, has increased there. So things are moving in China's favor for sure. This is what the U.S. Naval Institute wrote just a few days ago, 8th of June, about the Singapore summit. "China and North Korea are both playing a long-term strategy game. The United States must be aware that the Singapore summit is likely part of both nations' strategies." It says, "Positively influencing the denuclearization of North Korea is an intelligent tactical move that could go a long way toward achieving one of China's long-term strategic objectives of diminishing U.S. influence in the region, further isolating Taiwan from Western influence, and establishing itself as a superpower on the world stage." Now, I believe this is a very logical read on what is happening here. And this article says that the United States tends to play more of a short-term game in short-term gains in its foreign policy, where China tends to play the long game. It says, while the U.S. is distracted by quick head-to-head interactions, denuclearization of North Korea, a status which can be reversed quickly, fits nicely into China's and North Korea's strategy of building influence by going around barriers and taking a longer-term approach. Taking advantage of the United States' short attention span, China's and North Korea's plans have been executed over a long time so as not to draw attention to their overarching goals. Increasing the capability and number of ballistic missile launches while simultaneously developing nuclear weapons, this is what happened last year, increased tensions in the region and created an international appetite for a non-military solution without overt Chinese involvement. Studying the disarmament of Libya, China and North Korea waited until the moment was right, then started their charm offensive. And it says, learning from Libya's history, China brought Kim Jong-un to China twice in recent months to ensure there'd be no deviation from the plan, starting with the Winter Olympics, followed by the return of three U.S. hostages and the signal to dismantle a North Korean nuclear weapon test site. They created a U.S. quote-unquote victory. China and North Korea could consider those events as their own victory, however, because they reduced U.S. leverage and could entice U.S. President Donald Trump to offer additional concessions. While China may favor trade concessions, North Korea will likely favor diminished presence and eventual complete withdrawal of U.S. forces on the Korean Peninsula. Neither Beijing nor Pyongyang may have to bargain for these concessions, as budgets and regional and domestic political pressure do the work for them. Another example of the long game. With U.S. forces diminished or absent from the Korean Peninsula and Chinese ties strengthened with the Philippines, this move would spell the eventual death of Taiwan's relationship with the West. Now, again, it's difficult to say exactly how this is going to play out, but it could be that the days of North Korea serving to provoke America are over, and the era when North Korea begins to integrate more into the rest of Asia are beginning. We might see America feel that the need for a robust presence in Asia isn't as strong as it once was. And you already see America beginning to pull out of that region and trying to reduce its presence over there, an overstretched America that has so many other priorities. And it could leave that area to be dominated even more by China than what we're already seeing. So this may well lead to greater peace in the short term, but it could also be a major step toward the fulfillment of the Bible's prophecies of an Asian superpower dominated by Russia and China, a superpower that will be a major player in the coming nuclear World War III. You can learn more about these prophecies by going to thetrumpet.com and reading our book, Russia and China in Prophecy.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Why are businesses taking sides on political and social issues totally unrelated to their business regarding gun rights, race, homosexuality, transgenderism? And what effect is this having on America economically and socially? We're going to learn the answers in this report from Andrew Miller.
In the past, companies often avoided taking controversial political stances for fear of alienating potential employees and/or customers. Not anymore. Companies and organizations across the nation are expected to stand up for politically correct values like abortion and homosexual rights, or face being socially ostracized. Political commentator Kevin Williams was fired 3 days after his first article was published in The Atlantic. The reason? Someone dug up a 4-year-old social media post where Williamson suggested that laws be changed so the penalty for abortion is the same as the penalty for murder. Initially, Williamson's boss thought his views on abortion shouldn't be a problem. a large segment of the American population believes killing an unborn child is just as bad as killing any other innocent person. Yet journalists from the New York Times, the New Republic, the Huffington Post, Mother Jones, Slate, The Guardian, and other publications denounced Williamson until The Atlantic caved in and fired him. And Williamson is far from the only person in America who has lost their job for expressing pro-life views. Harmony Dawes was fired from her job at a cleaning business in 2016 after she was named president of the Oregon Right to Life Movement, a pro-life advocacy group. And even though her work as a pro-life activist had nothing to do with her cleaning job, her boss said that being pro-life would cause Dawes to discriminate against other employees. Julianne Benzel, a history teacher at Rockland High School, was put on administrative leave last March. She suggested to students in the classroom that school administrators were practicing a double standard by supporting a gun control march while remaining neutral about an anti-abortion rally. And a quick Google search will reveal many other examples of people fired for defending the Bible's position on abortion, and even more examples of people fired for defending the Bible's position on sexuality. Russell Berger was the chief knowledge officer for the fitness company CrossFit Inc. until he expressed opposition to an LGBT pride event to be held at a CrossFit gym in Indiana. As someone who personally believes celebrating pride is a sin, I'd like to personally encourage CrossFit Infiltrate for standing by their convictions and refusing to host the workout, Berger wrote in a since-deleted tweet. Now, Berger never said anything to indicate that homosexuals or transgenders were unwelcome at CrossFit. He simply stated that he did not believe CrossFit should be hosting an LGBT pride event. Yet he faced such a backlash from the LGBT community that CrossFit fired him only hours after his tweet went viral. All-star pitcher Curt Schilling was fired from ESPN after he posted an opinion on Facebook stating that grown men should not be able to use the same restrooms as young girls. Charles Rhodes Jr. was fired from SPX Flow Technology after he refused to look at a homosexual coworker's wedding photos. Atlanta Fire Chief Kevin Cochran was fired for writing a book condemning homosexuality as a sexual perversion. And Mozilla CEO Brandon Eich had to resign after LGBT activists found out that he donated $1,000 to Prop 8, a California initiative to ban same-sex marriage. Now, none of these people were fired because their views on homosexuality or abortion affected their job performance. They were fired because the companies they worked for feared the backlash from LGBT activists. Social justice purveyors talk about tolerance, but they're becoming increasingly intolerant of any position other than their own. And this is an intentional strategy to revolutionize the nation. It's easy to lose track of just how radically society has changed in the past 70 years. Yet many of the moral positions people are being fired for today were mainstream less than a generation ago. The idea that abortion is murder and marriage is a union between a man and a woman were once taken for granted. Now expressing such opinions in public can get you in a lot of trouble. Yet the Bible lists this moral inversion as one of the many signs of Jesus Christ's imminent return. In 2 Timothy 3, it says, "This know also that in the last days perilous times will come, for men will be lovers of their own selves, covetous, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy, without natural affection, truce breakers, false accusers, incontinent, fierce, despisers of those that are good, traitors, heady, high-minded, lovers of pleasure more than lovers of God, having a form of godliness but denying the power thereof, from such turn away." Now this passage explained that in the last days men would have a form of godliness. They would have their own moral code that differed from God's moral code. In fact, they would be despisers of those that are good. And this is an apt description of modern society. Not only do people tolerate practices the Bible condemns as evil, they despise those who stand up for biblical truth. Society is coming to the point where they uphold an anti-Bible morality. And through the prophet Isaiah, God warns against this type of thinking, saying, "Woe to them that call evil good and good evil, that put darkness for light and light for darkness, that put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. Woe to them that are wise in their own eyes and prudent in their own sight. God does not implement random laws for the sake of having laws, but God implements laws to increase our happiness and personal fulfillment. American society's intolerance of God's laws is leading to its own destruction. And only once people realize this fact will Jesus Christ be able to intervene and end this upside-down world.
Thank you, Andrew. It amazes me how what a powerful tool social media is proving to be. In so many of the examples that you're talking about, it was social media that enabled a group of people to demand that this person be fired or that pressure be brought to bear against a particular company, organization. It's really doing a lot to bring about these societal changes that you're talking about. How much would you say social media factors in?
Well, it really has revolutionized society because anyone, anywhere can say anything, anytime. And like you said, that is kind of one of the examples that I saw a headline the other day that basically said that everyone's only one tweet away from being fired. In this environment, it's not necessarily like it was in the past, where if you were expressing an opinion, you can express something in confidence with that. Where you're on social media, it can be anyone can see that. And there is a small group of, I guess, what you'd call like social justice warriors that are specifically combing for opinions that go against their worldview to try to silence that discussion.
Yeah.
And so I think when I talked about the fire chief that had been written, he was fired for writing a book. And he wrote a book for like his Baptist church, didn't really have anything to do with his job. I think he may have given it to a couple of his friends at work, but then eventually kind of keep getting passed around and passed around. And then someone who was homosexual found out that he had these private opinions from his church against homosexuality, and then just really made a big issue of it, that you can't be a fire chief anymore if you think that in your private life. And that's one of the examples that took a little more work, because it's actually a book he wrote that had to get passed around. Now, if he would have been at some of the other examples where he like tweeted something or put it on Facebook, you can do word searches and try to find out who's making those opinions and try to shut that down and silence it.
Right. And it's amazing how it's a small group of people. I mean, you said it, you called them social justice warriors, who would take the most extreme view that, say, any view to the contrary is unorthodox, unacceptable within public discussion. Say a fire chief who has these views in private, he's no longer a legitimate contender to have a public office like that because he holds a view of what really 10 years ago would have been very much a mainstream view. We've moved very quickly to a much more radical and much more intolerant view. And it really is the individuals who are doing this are leveraging the power that they have, driving the discussion, the public discussion on these issues in a way that is really quite extraordinary, to where you have mainstream companies, you have, even in the case of a fire chief, you have public services that are having to make concessions to this force within society in order to presumably avoid any further repercussions.
Yeah, that is amazing just how unrelated a lot of these firings are to what the job actually entails. I mean, I guess if you're like, if you bake wedding cakes for a living, at some point you're going to have to take a stance on whether you agree with homosexual marriage or not. Mm-hmm. But like I said, if you're a cleaning lady in Oregon or a fire chief in Atlanta, your opinions on homosexual marriage or abortion aren't really relevant to your job. Mm-hmm. They don't affect how you do your job really in any way. These are private opinions that they're searching. It's almost like a, we'd call like a witch hunt, where you're searching, a reverse witch hunt, where you're searching for the people who have these opinions in their private life and trying to push them out of public position. The abortion one is kind of interesting, too, is that that's not even the idea that abortion and murder are equivalent is not even a rare opinion amongst the American people. Probably about 40% of the American people believe that,
right.
So maybe not a majority, but close to half the American people would agree that abortion is murder, and yet you see just more examples after examples that if you express that opinion in the public sphere, you're not on the right half of the population that gets to have an opinion.
Yeah, that's right. So because of the way that this small group of people is leveraging the influence that they have, their voice is actually shouting down what in many cases would be certainly the opinion of a large number of Americans, if not the majority of Americans. Their voice is actually coming to dominate public discussion to the point where major companies are having to come out and to say, we are proud supporters of LGBT rights, that type of thing. It's not an ethical decision. It's not a moral decision on their part. It's a business decision that it is actually more profitable for us to announce ourselves as being pro whatever the case might be than to remain on the sidelines of this discussion.
That's absolutely right. I mean, large portions, and in some case maybe even a majority of Americans do have opinions against things like abortion or redefining marriage. But for the most part, they're a silent majority. They're not
right.
Trying to force their opinion on anyone else, where on the other side of the spectrum, you've definitely got almost more of a fringe element that have very strong anti-biblical, anti-Judeo-Christian values that they are trying to force on society, and they're willing to take the go the extra mile to make it an issue. And so, I mean, the pressure they're putting on companies, like you said, does make it a business decision that rather than try to bear up under the bad publicity, it's easy just to crack and fire somebody.
Yeah.
And move on.
What a phenomenal dynamic we're seeing unfold within American society. As you're describing it, this group of virulently radical and aggressive individuals who are pushing a very anti-biblical view, and they're using these tools very effectively in order to drive public discussion. And on the other side, who knows how many, a majority more, who disagree and yet who don't have that same attachment, I guess, or they're not pushing those beliefs. They just hold those beliefs and they're just going about their business, but they're just proving to be an insufficient defense against the offensive that's coming from the other direction.
Right. Yeah, I would definitely say that, like, the biggest cause of, like, the moral decline of America is more apathy. The apathy of the majority. I mean, there's definitely a very vocal minority who are staunchly against anything relating to the Bible or Judeo-Christian values. That's been true for the better part of a century. They didn't get as far in generations past just because they had they were in the
more
minority.
Resistance.
But they're now a minority.
Well, they're still in the minority, but they just don't. They're not facing the resistance that they would have at one time within American society. It just reminds me of the way that that's described in Daniel 8, I believe it is, where it talks about individuals who are casting truth to the ground, and it's just people who didn't have enough love for the truth to be able to defend themselves against the attack. That seems to be what's happening. That certainly happened on a spiritual level within God's church, but it certainly seems to be happening on a society-wide level in America today. We've been talking with trumpet writer Andrew Miller about just the politicization of everything, how businesses are coming to take political and social views on issues that are unrelated to the businesses that they promote. He's working on an article about this subject for the coming print edition of the Trumpet magazine. You can watch for that on thetrumpet.com. Thanks for your time, Andrew.
Thanks for having me.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
Moral relativism. Whether something is right or wrong all depends on the circumstances. This has been the prevailing view in the West for a couple of generations now, and it can lead people into some awfully convoluted thinking. We'll hear a stunning example in this report from Richard Palmer.
Hakani had one of the most traumatizing childhoods imaginable. She was born in 1995 to the Suhuaha tribe in Brazil. Her name means smile. But in her early childhood, she didn't have many opportunities for that. At the age of two, she'd not learned to walk or talk. Now, tribal customs in this place were clear. The tribal elders declared that this disability meant that she had no soul and that she should be killed. Her parents killed themselves rather than follow through with the tribal custom. Then her 15-year-old brother tried to bury her alive. But after she kept crying, someone dug her up. So then the task fell to her grandfather. He shot her with an arrow. And he was so upset by that experience that he also committed suicide. But Hakani survived. So the tribe abandoned her in the forest. She was left to live there alone for 3 years. She stayed alive just about only because her brother smuggled her food, as well as eating just plants and insects, whatever she could find there. Her arrow wound became infected. She was incredibly thin. She still couldn't walk or talk. And then her brother brought her to Marcia and Edson Suzuki, a missionary couple that were working in the area. They rescued her, they cared for her, they got her medical help, and within a year, she was walking, she was talking. Soon she was able to attend school, back just to being a normal little girl. The Suzukis took Hakani back to the tribe, but they couldn't find anyone to care for her there, so the Suzukis adopted her. Now, Hakani's case caused controversy. The Brazilian Public Prosecutor's Office, when they heard about this, they decided that they were going to take action. But not against those that tried to murder a child. Instead, they recommended that all non-natives be banned from the lands of the Zuhuara tribe. They wanted to make it impossible for people like the Suzukis to rescue another child. Believe it or not, the question, should we allow indigenous tribes to murder children, is a controversial one. Now, it's hard to get good figures on this, but it's believed that around 20 tribes in the Amazonian region follow this practice. Victims include the disabled. They include children born to single mothers. Some tribes believe that twins don't have souls, and so they'll kill one or both of those. So in 2007, a bill was introduced in Brazil's Congress aiming to stamp out infanticide in tribal communities. It was named after an indigenous mother who refused or who did not want to follow the tribal customs and kill her disabled daughter in 2005. And it required the government to look out for and to protect babies that would be in this position, to keep track of parents who were expecting twins, children that might have deformities, disabilities, to make sure that they weren't murdered. But it was controversial. Foreign Policy wrote, it immediately created tensions between those who champion universal human rights, which prioritize the individual, and those who support cultural relativism, which favors the freedom of communities to organize themselves according to their own moral codes. It took 8 years to get that bill through Brazil's Congress, and it's still not passed Brazil's Senate. So stopping children being murdered is so controversial, it's not been passed into law yet. It seems astonishing that anyone could justify these practices, but they do. Foreign Policy paraphrases an anonymous government anthropologist saying that child killing among indigenous people must be understood in the context of the Amazon's incredibly harsh environment. So, okay, well, if you know a bit about the background, it's okay. You'll understand it's okay to kill children. And so, you know, there's government departments that want to sweep this under the rug. Brazil's National Indian Foundation, again, that's a government department. It says that even talking about it, quote, is in many cases an attempt to incriminate and express prejudice against indigenous people. One Brazilian news source, they wrote that there are some anthropologists that argue that the death of babies is part of the cultural identity of these indigenous populations, and white people don't have to understand it. So if you want to stop them killing the babies, well, apparently it's racism. Another anthropologist, they said that by saving Hakani, these Suzukis, quote, stood in the way of the realization of a cultural practice filled with meaning. So killing babies is filled with meaning. He said that the Suzukis made a big mistake and that they did irreparable damage to the tribe's way of life because they brought Hakani back and tried to convince them that murdering children was wrong. But the Suzukis have saved lives, more than just Hakani's life. In 2005, after the Suzukis' quote, big mistake, well, two of these tribal families decided that they weren't going to kill their disabled children, but look for medical help instead. This is the extreme of moral relativism. You know, if a tribe thinks that murdering a child is good, well, who are we to disagree? You know, we have to understand their background, where they're coming from. It sounds like a hypothetical scenario that someone's dreamt up, something that's too extreme to exist in real life, to point to the flaws in moral relativism. But there are actually some out there that make this argument. This is the end result of promoting tolerance as really the only absolute good. Everything else, even moral qualms about murdering babies, has to go. But the fact is, sometimes tolerance is evil. Tolerating murdering children is clearly evil. And this is why the trumpet warns. This is why we do the job that we do. Because the West is also destroying children. It's maybe not having murdering them with their own parents, but the facts are abundantly clear. We're living ways of life that destroys families, ways that destroys young people. There are so many sins, so many problems in the West, destroying the lives of people young and old. So many, and especially on the left, kind of preach, as I said, tolerance is the big absolute virtue. You know, you may disagree with how other people behave, but don't stand in the way of them doing it. But the sins that we see so prevalently in the US and in the West, they do more damage than the infanticide in Brazil. I mean, Brazil has fewer than 1 million indigenous people, and most of those tribes don't practice this. Now, every child murdered is a huge tragedy, but far more children are being destroyed in the United States, in the West, in Britain, by our corrupt lifestyles. Now, even as rampant as moral relativism is today, I'm sure it's clear to the vast majority that infanticide, that murdering babies is something that should not be tolerated. So why do we tolerate so many behaviours that destroy so many more young people? And this is why God commands us to cry aloud, spare not, lift up your voice like a trumpet, and show my people their transgressions and the house of Jacob their sins. God wants us to live a joyful life, a happy life. He wants all of us to have an abundant life. If we warn people that they're destroying themselves, that they're harming their children, they have a chance to turn it around. The Suzuki's message, save 2 children in 1 year alone. This message can save some from the way of life that causes misery and suffering. But God isn't content with just saving the few that respond to the message that we send out today. He has a plan to save the entire world, even those that have already died, from this way of suffering. He has a plan to soon end the infanticide of indigenous tribes and the self-destruction of the West. And this forms another core part of our message, a warning that God will not tolerate our evil way of life and the suffering it brings, and that he will soon end it. He's soon going to bring in a world full of hope and a world full of joy. This is the message that we have to get out. And if you want to know more about it, you can read our article, Why We Must Warn, on the Trumpet website.
Thank you very much for that, Richard. That is quite an example that you used to bring out that point. We were talking earlier to Andrew Miller about how the left is using social media to enforce a very strict morality on society. You know, they're very condemning when it comes to certain elements of what they view as what is moral and immoral. It's such an interesting contrast with this idea that you also see them hold regarding some of the more evil practices in the world. Like the one that you were describing, you know, you do your thing, I'll do mine. It's a very two very different approaches that are being held within the same mind.
Yes, it seems, you know, by putting tolerance as kind of the absolute good, the only absolute good, you end up tying yourself in all sorts of these kind of moral knots where, okay, well, which tolerance trumps what? And
right.
You get into all of these really awkward positions. But it's kind of like we've come now, you've had kind of like a pendulum swing where maybe 100 or 200 years ago, we would have gone in there and taken all of these tribes and tried to make them live in a Western way with Western dress and exactly, you know, in that standard. And now it's kind of swung to this complete opposite extreme of, well, we'll tolerate absolutely anything. And if they want to kill children, well, you know, we've got to understand their background and where they've coming from and that's their culture. And we just need to tolerate that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of something that you can kind of relish a little bit when you see the left in these kind of moral pickles. Someone was telling me about a scenario where there was a man who said something like, well, women shouldn't have careers of their own. And the woman responds, well, you are just a bigot, a Republican pig that, you know, this and that. And he says, well, I'm actually not a Republican. I'm a Muslim. And she says, Oh, I'm so terribly sorry. I hope that you don't think that I'm Islamophobic. But you hear the condemnation of those who would say, be against homosexuality, or they would the way that people would view it, that they're anti-women's rights. And yet if you see that happening in Iran, or if it's a Muslim country, then the left goes silent about that.
Yeah, and it wasn't always this way. You know, there was a time where we had a belief in things and absolute rights and absolute wrongs, and the West had a moral code. And they weren't afraid to act on that moral code. And the classic example with the British Empire was, we got to India. One of the practices that was widespread, at least in certain parts of India and certain Hindu communities, was that if somebody was a widow, if their husband died, their husband would be cremated. And they were expected, the wife was expect, or the widow was expected to jump on the funeral pyre. And sometimes that jumping on the funeral pyre was much less of a voluntary jump. This Britain initially, when it was kind of the East India Company and it was more about profit, kind of tolerated this. By about the 1830s, there was a massive outcry. It was outlawed. Britain pretty much wiped this practice out. Mm-hmm. And that was the way, you know, that was an absolute code and that was wrong. It was the same. I mean, that's an example from another culture. I mean, even from our own culture, Britain decided slavery
was wrong in the late 18th century, early 19th century. And then that became part of the major missions of the Royal Navy, was stamping out slavery. If the Royal Navy would go and it would seek out and capture ships involved in slave trading, because that was an absolute wrong, we were going to stand up for that. We were going to stop it. Mm-hmm. And sure, those moral codes were not perfect. Sure, they were upheld in hypocritical ways. They were, say, ignored by people in power at times, and not everybody adhered to them. But that was a lot better of a way of dealing with things than the opposite, where there's just no moral code whatsoever in the situation we have now, where it's, well, okay, killing children, well, if that's your belief, so be it.
Right. And I did appreciate the way that you tied that in with the fact that we do have a work to do in warning people about the consequences of the choices that they're making. The idea that people could behave in any which way, and, you know, as long as you're just kind of doing that in the privacy of your own bedroom or wherever, whatever the case might be, it doesn't affect me, is just flat out wrong. And there's a whole lot to prove that. It was a very good point that you made there. We've been talking with trumpet writer Richard Palmer about moral relativism. He wrote about this in his trumpet brief yesterday. This is a free email brief that you can receive each day with news and analysis from our staff. Just go to thetrumpet.com and you can sign up for it. You can also read his article about this subject. Is murdering children wrong? The left isn't sure. We really appreciate your time, Richard.
See you next time.
It's time for today's last word.
Tomatoes enjoy summers in Oklahoma, I've been delighted to learn. I'm not much of a gardener, but for some years I've loaded my little garden patch with several varieties of tomato plants. Harvest lasts several weeks, during which my children and I can collect a bucket full of fruit nearly every day. It's wonderfully gratifying. Two grapevines off my back porch, though, are much less impressive. Now and again, we'll be able to fill a medium-sized bowl with small clusters of grapes, enough for a snack, but not much of a harvest. I'm thankful that my family's sustenance isn't dependent on my success as a vine dresser. I can easily attribute my lack of produce to my lack of competence and lack of effort. But imagine a master farmer who works hard, who gives his crops every possible advantage, yet still doesn't receive the harvest his efforts should yield. This was God's frustrating experience with ancient Israel, and tragically with most of his people in this end time. Like any farmer, God planted Israel in order to get fruit. Isaiah 5 says that God has a vineyard in a very fruitful hill, and he fenced it and gathered out the stones thereof and planted it with the choicest vine and built a tower in the midst of it and also made a wine press therein, and he looked that it should bring forth grapes. God labored over and cared for and invested in the Israelites, protecting, watering, and nourishing them in the wilderness, planting them in the glorious promised land, removing enemy peoples, building his temple among them, being present with them. He exerted the same effort in modern times with spiritual Israel. When God makes that kind of investment, he expects fruit. He wants his people to flourish, flower, and produce fruit, spiritual fruit, that he can enjoy and use to feed other people. Think about all the effort God has devoted to you. We're all beneficiaries, but especially those in his church whom he's planted in good soil, given every nutrient in his word, watered with his spirit, bathed in his sunshine, diligently removed weeds in our character. So over time, he looks for fruit. And you should show the fruit of his spirit listed in Galatians 5, more of his love, joy, peace, patience, faith, self-control, and so on, a greater measure of his very nature. You should show more of his wisdom and his mind, have more acts that reflect his indwelling presence. That is sweet, wonderful fruit. That passage in Isaiah 5 goes on to show that ancient Israel and spiritual Israel in this end time brought forth wild fruit, corrupt, bitter grapes. God did all that he could to bring a marvelous harvest, yet these people gave him unusable produce, and he was left no choice but to lay the crop waste. God has an unusual challenge as a vine dresser. The fruit of his vine doesn't come inevitably given the right conditions. It actually has a will of its own. It can receive every good benefit and still refuse to produce. Jesus Christ said in John 15 that the way to be fruitful is to remain attached to him, the vine. If we abide in Christ, we'll bear much fruit, and even then God will prune us to improve our yield still more. But if we're fruitless, we're worthless to God. In Hosea 10, God uses the same analogy to make a slightly different accusation. He says, Israel is an empty vine. He brings forth fruit unto himself. According to the multitude of his fruit, he's increased the pagan altars. According to the goodness of his land, they've made goodly images. So this is a terrible affront to God. People using all of the advantages that he gave them to satisfy their own interests, to serve their own gods. That angers God when he sees his people wasting his blessings and care on themselves rather than producing fruit for him and for others, seeking their own things, not the things which are Jesus Christ's, taking credit for their blessings, allowing those blessings to draw them away from him rather than toward him. It's like a plant that puts all its energy into big, beautiful leaves, but whose fruit is hard, tiny, and tasteless. Christ condemned the hypocrites who gave alms, who prayed and fast to receive praise from men rather than to draw close to God. Verily I say unto you, he said, they have their reward. When we selfishly use or abuse the blessings God gives us, we can expect him to remove them. God says to us, as he said to Baruch, seek you great things for yourself? Seek them not. God wants us to fast to him, not even to eat and drink to ourselves. As Romans 14 says, for none of us lives to himself, and no man dies to himself. For whether we live unto the Lord. And whether we die unto the Lord. Whether we live, therefore, or die, we are the Lord's. It's a vivid picture we all need to remember. Never forget your purpose. You exist to produce fruit, not for yourself, but for God. It's to his credit and for his purposes and his glory. And the greater care God takes for you, the greater should be your yield. The richer your blessings, the more abundant should be your spiritual fruit to the glory and for the use of the Master Gardener. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. Send us your comments on the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Andrew Miller and Richard Palmer. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with this thought from Will Durant. I think the ability of the average man could be doubled if the situation demanded. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.